Okay, just to keep you appraised of what's going on, Ryan, the youngest boy, tested positive and negative for COVID, so obviously they're taking the safe route and isolating, so certainly pray for them because this affects Mary's ability to be able to support herself. She can only do, apparently, appraisals where either people aren't home or the house is empty and they're waiting, trying to sell it. She called them drive-bys, and I thought, well, I won't tell them you're out doing drive-bys. But it was a run-by fruiting. So pray for them, obviously. And apparently, from what we understand, Ryan actually only had symptoms for like probably 3 or 4 days, I guess. He had a fever and a headache, and then that all went away, and you know, he's probably fine, it sounds like, which is good. That's good news. We certainly want everybody to survive, and so certainly pray for them, and we're still maintaining basic common sense. Again, if people want to wear masks, we're not going to look bad at you. If you want to wear one, that's fine. All of us are all of us are evil. No, I mean, well, maybe two. All of us are well, and most of us have actually been tested. So, and I suspect from what I've heard, and I think you all probably know as well, that if you get it, you know it. Yeah, you don't have to guess. There are some pretty serious symptoms that you'll pick up pretty quick. So, the reality is, again, still they don't know how it's spreading, frankly, because there's been mask mandates for 6 months now or more, and it's still spreading. Then again, you've got parts of the culture who, you know, ignore it and don't use it or anything. So the fact is, God, we just pray for God to keep us safe and trust Him. And if he takes me out, whether it's COVID or cancer, it doesn't matter, does it? I'm going to die one way or the other. And you know, I don't want to die, but on the other hand, I'd rather be raptured. But the fact is that we recognize that our lives are in his hands. He has this all under control. This isn't some panic deal for him. Oh, I didn't know this was going to happen. I don't know how to handle it. So we know he does. And just keeping your good common sense and your wits about you and just not giving into the panic and the stupidity that the cosmos does. And the fact is, frankly, too, I've heard isolated stories, not all the time, but like our PA at the pain management place, she said her son works out in construction. He's never within 50 yards of anybody, and he got it. And he doesn't run around the bars, doesn't socialize, didn't do any of that, and he got it out in the middle of nowhere. So tell me how he got it, and I'll be happy to know. But I don't think anybody knows. I mean, viruses are just small. They're easily spread. So, and the good thing is we have seen, of course, initially I think they thought this was going to be a 4 or 5% death rate, and it's still only about 2, which is 4 times probably worse than the flu, 4 or 5 times. But it is just a virus. There's not a whole lot you can do about those because there's not a lot of good antivirals. We got a lot of antibiotics. Those are good for bacteria, but not for viruses. Okay, well, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here. We're ready to move ahead now with verse 17 as Paul has instructed these believers to be careful how you walk. He's mentioned this at least twice. Being careful how you walk, learning what's pleasing to the Lord, and don't walk like fools walk. Don't order your lifestyle as other people out here in the cosmos. They don't have anything to offer. This is the problem. The believer has to come to recognize that the cosmos is bankrupt spiritually. It has nothing to offer. And all it can offer is darkness. And we're here to expose that. As light, that's our nature. We can't help it at a certain level. We have to expose the nonsense and be even-handed about it, of course. And we talked about the whole, you know, love the sinner but hate the sin. We're not against people. We're not against anybody. Shouldn't be anyway. Everybody has the same opportunity to come to faith that you and I did. This is God's plan. And I'm glad he gave me the opportunity, free will, so he's got to give it to everybody. If you want the right to live your own life and make your own decisions, you have to grant that to everybody. Honestly. Because God does. And or you can be maladjusted and say, I'm going to live my life my way, but you've got to live it my way too. And we'll see how successful that is. It doesn't work. You can't control people. So now, again, be careful how you walk, not as fools, but as wise men. Unwise men is a synonym for fools. Making the most of your time. Again, looking at the opportunities, being aware of them, praying, being patient. And most of us live pretty, hopefully, you're living a pretty simple lifestyle and niche. I mean, God can throw something at you out of the clear blue. But the issue is on this making the most of your time and all of that, where are our largest opportunities for divine good production? In the home. Shock, shock. How we live in our house. What we do. The things we do there. That's a ton of SG3 is going to come from there, or maybe not, in the alternative. But that, and again, we're going to be coming up on that here pretty quick. We'll see what the home life is supposed to be that is characteristic of believers with maximum doctrine and who have filled spirits. That's how we're supposed to live. And so, and let's just face it, if you can't get in fellowship and apply towards the person you married, how well are you going to do out there in the cosmos? That's much harder. We say it is, but not necessarily. I remember they had it back years ago. I saw it and I thought it was just hilarious. I never went and saw it because I'm not a big arts guy, but they had this play called I Love You, You're Perfect, Please Change. And I think that expresses a lot of marriage in some way. You get married, oh, I love you, you're perfect, oh, I all that. Then, the blinders come on. Now change. So, but as we're going to find out, you can't change each other. You can only change yourself. So now verse 17 here, let's move on. Do not be a foolish, is the way the New American Standard translated it. What we have here is, so then, is actually the preposition dia, because of or on account of this, houtas. On account, and of course this is what you have, immediately you're trained, I was anyway. All right, what's the antecedent of this? On account of this. And so we'll have to identify that, and we'll do that here in the exposition of this. It's something, obviously, it reaches back to the preceding context. Generally speaking, now, in some cases, you can use this demonstrative adjective, houtas, and this I say to you, and then the this can follow, the what I'm saying to you can follow. But most often, it's used a previous context. So it's something Paul had said before. So on account of this, do not become, literally. Negative may with the verb genomai. And I'm still a little puzzled with the New American Standard sometimes that they don't know the difference between genomai and imi. That is pretty standard first year stuff. That's vocabulary words. And they don't know the difference between be and become. And so he's implying here, I think, that he doesn't think they're foolish now. He's warning them not to fall into this. So this isn't an indictment. This is a prohibition for them to stop and think, to consider where they are, and to avoid becoming something other than what they're doing right now. I don't see in this letter that we've gone through, I have not seen a whole lot of rebukes at all. I still haven't seen anything real personal. Now, Paul, obviously, this epistle is somewhat general, no doubt. But Paul obviously knows some things about what's going on in Ephesus. Paul had contacts, and some of these people traveled frequently. Those two tent makers. I kept thinking Ananias and Sapphira, but that's not it. The two tent makers that he worked with there. Priscilla and Aquila, yeah. They apparently were in a lot of places. They apparently had been in Ephesus. They were in Rome. We know they were in Rome about the time he wrote the Romans, which would have been just previous to this. But they appeared to have, you know, who knows, maybe they had a chain of tent-making things. They could have. Because you had, you know, you had the whole gamut in first century Christianity, just as you do today. You have some believers that struggle, that never really make much. Then you had people that owned their own line of tent making factories. And they did quite nicely, probably. Thank you. And so they appear to have had business dealings in several places. So they would have given him probably information as they had it. And of course, there was more travel in the ancient world. It was more difficult, we know that. But there was more travel than people might imagine that went on. So he's not saying, hey, I think you're foolish now. He's saying, don't become this. Don't change what you're doing in that sense. Do not become, I've translated this senseless, is aphron. A-P-H-R-O-N. The adjective here, predicate, adjective, nominative, masculine, plural, actually, this is, if you translate it literally, don't become senseless ones. Don't become senseless people, is the idea here. And aphron comes from phrein, to think something, to think properly. But the alpha prefix negates it. And it means 11 times it's used, lacking good sense or good judgment. Foolish, senseless, or stupid. I like senseless better because it kind of implies that you're not thinking as well as you should be. People can become senseless. So do not become senseless. And again, you see, one of the things I think that stands out in Paul's writings is this constant emphasis on the mental attitude, your thinking processes. Because he knows this is where it all begins and ends, in a sense. I mean, it ends in the outplay of actually applying doctrine, but obviously it all starts right up here. It's how you think, what you think, when you think, why you think, who you listen to, how you listen to it. There's all kinds of things that factor into this. Some people, they don't listen to the right material. Well, their head's filled up with gumbo. It's not good stuff. It's sticky. And you can't get past it. You can't think. And many people don't know how to think. And you have to recognize this when you're dealing with people. And even among believers who do know how to think, we all have our good days and bad days. We're going to fail. We're going to let you down. Hopefully we don't mean to. I don't know. Hopefully you don't do it on purpose. But we go through that. Well, again, how are you going to get out of it when you're having a bad day? It's going to be your thinking. It's going to be up here. And God the Holy Spirit works with all of this. And, of course, then resident doctrine that we have in our souls. Or the human spirit, at any rate. So then, on account of this, do not become senseless ones. But strong adversity of conjunction, this always sets up a correction. But what is the correction to being senseless? It's understanding. But then here you have a present active imperative of suniemi. S-U-N-I-E-M-I. Suniemi, this means to have an intelligent grasp of something. To understand or to comprehend. So understand or comprehend would be a good way to translate this. They've gone with understand. That's fine. But also notice this. Maybe I should have underlined that. But this is an imperative. It's a command. Don't do this, but, or don't become this, but do this. But understand what, interrogative pronoun tis here, introduces here a question of sorts, an indirect question. What is the will of the Lord? The question is, what is the will of the Lord? How do we know what it is? Well, whatever it is, we need to understand it. And we need to be clear on it. And this is why we have sound teaching. So that we can be clear on these things. The superficial way of treating the Bible that I've seen in the past with people doesn't get the job done. First, they don't spend enough time sometimes in passages even thinking about them. And like I told you, that one passage there about awake you that sleep. I must have gone over it 10 times before I really felt like, okay, I think I'm seeing what's going on here. And it doesn't all always come quickly. You say, well, you just go into the study and you probably sit there for 5 minutes and you write your 50-point summary. Oh, yeah, that's the way it works. That's the way it works. No. Sometimes I will sit there and have to think about something for an hour or two and never write anything. Just thinking through, okay, if this is this, And sometimes, you know, you use some thought processes and you try to work through things and you run through, okay, if this is true, then what does that mean here theologically and all of this? And you have to think about this stuff. It would be nice if it all came that easy. I would like it. 10 minutes in the study, I'm done. Take me longer to teach it than study it. It doesn't work that way. It takes a lot less time to teach it than it does to study it. What I can teach you in an hour probably takes me 5, 6 or more hours to put together. So that's the kind of the ratio. So what, an interrogative pronoun here, and you can supply a present tense of I me, what is the will of the Lord? That's the question. The will is tothelema, T-H-E-L-E-M-A. That's the neuter of the definite article. The will, an accusative here of content. What is the will of the Lord? Hokurios, definite article, again, with the term Lord. And it's always been a reference to Jesus as the Lord here. And this is a subjective genitive. The will of the Lord would be better, or is at least understood as, what does God will? God is the one doing the willing. The question is, are we acclimating to his will, whatever it may be? And the fact is, if you don't acclimate to the will of God, well, he can find ways to get your attention and let you know that you have it. All right, point one here. Paul begins verse 17 with a construction that he uses frequently. The prepositional phrase dia here, tuto, because of this, is used to reference something in the preceding context. The two interpreters are somewhat divided as to whether or not he is referencing the last statement at the end of verse 16, that last statement dealing with the fact that the days are evil, that they are filled with active attacking evil in the Christian life and in the world. So is the last statement at the end of verse 16 regarding the evil nature of the time in which believers live? Or if Paul is referencing the matter of being careful regarding their Christian walk, from back in verse 15, be careful how you walk, or is he referencing the second statement, not as unwise men, or whether back in verse 15, or the final statement at the end of verse 16, which kind of completes the thought, be careful how you walk, because the days are evil. And that's an explanation, because of all of this, therefore, don't be foolish. So in that regard, the last part of verse 16 indicates that just as evil times supply the reason for redeeming the time, the nature of the times also supply the reason for the believer to not become unthinking, but to up his mental game. And a lot of believers don't want to up their mental game. This is why they don't put up a sound doctrine, because this is challenging, let's face it. I know it can be technical sometimes. I try to winnow it down somewhat as much as I can. But I'm not only doing the work just for you. When I don't want to do the kind of work. I say, well, yeah, he did this great work, but he didn't document anything he said. He didn't classify this. He didn't do that. Some of this is for people down the road, too, that look at it and say, hey, this is what these verses are saying. So, but I try to keep it as simple as possible. But it is technical sometimes. It is difficult. It is challenging. It's challenging for me. And I even have all the tools. I know, you know, some of you don't have the languages and hermeneutics and all this and that. Well, you don't have to, for one thing, if I do my job right. But, and some of you do. But the point is, it needs to be something that you don't want to teach. And here's what, you know, I was taught with Microsoft, you know, write your documents on a sixth grade level. No, I'm not doing that. I don't think that challenges believers enough. And points out to them, number one, I'm not trying to impress you or anything, but some of this stuff is hard to work through. You can see it in Bible class, I think. And so we're not going to dumb it down, but we need to be able to communicate in such a way that even if a person comes in and they're positive, that they can plug in. Now, they may not pick it up all right away, and they won't. But they can learn and grow, and these things will build up in them over time as they pursue the truth. And so, here, we recognize the times are evil, and so you have to up your thinking game. You have to be more rigorous, more disciplined. It's a challenge. Because let's just face it, I don't know about you, but as last time I checked, water takes the path of least resistance. It always flows downhill. And the fact is, this is for believers. It's easy to take the path. And I don't know how you all feel about this. I haven't interviewed all of you, or even many of you. But this business of class and how much we've missed, and the on and off nature of what we've had to do sometimes, it's frustrating to me. I try to stay past the frustration. But it also makes it easier. Well, let's just all stay at home. Let's not even get out. We'll just do this over the internet. That's where a lot of churches have headed. Some have been forced there. Although, I did notice the other day, apparently the courts have sided with churches and you can't close their doors. You don't have that right as the government. But that pretty much is actually what the separation of church and state's about. The government can't run in and start issuing edicts to the church. But we recognize it's difficult times and all of that. So guess what? You're going to have to be more rigorous, not less. And this matter of all the class we miss and stuff, and some of it's been unavoidable, some of it's been personal stuff, some of it's been, you know, the just precautionary and all of that. But it takes its toll on me. I know in my Christian life, I feel it. I feel the lack of food. Let's see, when was the last time we ate? Oh, last week. Well, try that today. Have lunch when you go home. And then don't eat again until next Sunday. And see how you do. And I'll bet you money you'll suffer. And suffer badly after a point. After about 3 or 4 days, the good thing is you won't be hungry anymore. But boy, those first 3 or 4 days are tough. But we're missing our spiritual food. We're missing the fellowship, the camaraderie, you know. And it takes a toll. And I think, okay, well, if I'm the pastor and I've been at this for however long it's been total, 31 years here, and if it's taking a toll on me, I got to believe it takes a toll on every one of you. And it should. It should take a toll. That means we're actually healthy, that we need this stuff. And we want it. But again, we'll have to make decisions. I know, like with Truth, you can continue to pray for them there in Oklahoma City. The last 2 weeks, the mayor that shut it down. And so they went ahead and complied, even though they probably could have met face to face. They gone ahead and complied. Their classes are now, you know, broadcast again over the internet. And I know they want face to face teaching, these people and the pastor there. I feel for them, but God has blessed us. Number one, we don't have the mandates from the city or county or state that they do. And DeSantis isn't going to shut this thing down again. I guarantee he's not going to. And most people have recognized, sad as it may be, people just don't want to hear this thing has to run its course, just like everything in the world does. And there's not a whole lot we can do about it. Pray, use good sense, good hygiene. I bet you wash your hands more now, don't you? How many of you wash your hands more? Come on, admit it. You can tell me. I know I am. I do. And usually it's when I come back into the house. That's when I'm washing them. I'm not so concerned about what's going on in my house because I know it's well. But washing them, yeah. So we're going to have to up our thinking. This is tough. We live in difficult times. We're told it was going to be this way. We just may not imagine how difficult it's going to get. Some people were teaching years ago, I know, that because the U.S. appears to go into Daniel's 70th week, rich and prosperous, that nothing bad's going to happen to America. Gong. Mm-hmm. That's just not true. That's going beyond what the text said. And what is prosperity? For some people, you know, if you had $5,000, you'd be prosperous. Other people, you'd have to have $50 million to be prosperous. Well, it varies from person to person. So, yeah, the country largely goes into Daniel's 70th week unprepared and just doing their thing. But that doesn't mean bad things aren't going to happen or that difficult times aren't going to come. So four here, Paul once again provides a contrast by first setting forth the prohibition. Do not become foolish, which is set against the positive command to understand God's will. And five, some interpreters have suggested when the negative may is used with the present imperative, it has the sense of forbidding an action that's already in progress. So while that may be true in certain contexts, you got to be careful with that. I think we've mentioned this before. It may do that, but in this case, it doesn't. Because one of the things, the reason it doesn't, is the nature of the verb itself. That has to be considered. So he's not saying to them, well, that may be true in certain contexts. The exegete must consider the context carefully before presuming that an action in progress is being addressed. In this case, one should not understand this as a command to stop being foolish. See, that's how you would translate. If you want to translate as an action in progress, it would say, stop becoming foolish, indicating they already were doing this. But stop it in the future means stop it going forward doesn't indicate they were already doing it. It's a prohibition against starting it. So one should not understand this as a command to stop being foolish, but rather to a command to not start being foolish. The verb genomai indicates entry into a new state or condition. So he's not saying stop being foolish because you're being foolish now. He's saying don't be foolish going forward. And that is, to me, I haven't seen anything in the context of Ephesians that hasn't suggested that's been his tone all along. Now, I'm sure he knows issues and problems in that church or things that were going on. But he never says, oh, you're failing here and here and here and stop this and quit doing that. Not like you read the Corinthians, it's totally different. The Galatians, Corinthians, those books are wildly different. So in this case, the present tense of the verb has an ingressive and a progressive sense. The believer is not to start becoming foolish, nor is he to continue in that state. You don't want to be a fool in the end. The condition Paul wants them to avoid is that of becoming foolish. The adjective aphron, lacking good judgment or foolish, denotes one that is senseless, silly, or ignorant. One lacking in discretion, discernment and discretion. And again, why is discernment so important? Because the fact is, if you can't see things clearly, you're not going to make good decisions. You're going to be influenced by things that don't matter, or that are inconsequential. So here, such is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. And that term, the ignorance, is actually our term ignorance here, is the way they've translated it in that context. So in this context of this portion of Ephesians, the matter of foolishness would seem to primarily be related to the matter of the believer's lifestyle. I mean, he keeps talking about the walk. That's been the sort of the running theme here. Back from verse 10 even, verse 8 rather. Walk as children of light, and he provides these contrasts between light and darkness. And then in verse 15, be careful how you walk. And then don't be foolish. So this matter of the lifestyle is primarily, again, what seems to be in view. So beginning with chapter 4, Paul has strongly emphasized the matter of one's walk, about which he has said the following. A, it is to be worthy of one's high calling to God's plan. We have been called, we have been set apart, even from eternity past, but in time now, Ephesians 4:1, walk in a manner that's worthy. You've been called to be a son of God. What greater thing is there? To be a son of God, there isn't anything greater. That's the highest calling you can have. To emulate God, to be a part of his plan. So walk worthy, he says. B, it is a lifestyle that is contrasted with the futile lifestyles of unbelievers. This is the problem with the cosmos. They live in darkness, they walk in darkness, and their thinking processes are degraded and corrupt. And you wonder why they don't ever come to right conclusions. Well, they can't. They are consumed with darkness in their own will and their own views of things. And that's dangerous, frankly, for a believer. So this I say and affirm together with the Lord, that you walk no longer. Now, we did at one time. Maybe some of us didn't. So you might have been saved. You didn't go out there and hobnob with the cosmos and get involved with all the evil. Well, I did. And so that would be, okay, your pre-salvation state, you may have walked this way. Don't do it anymore. Change your lifestyle. That you walk no longer just as the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind. Their thinking is futile. They can't come to the correct conclusions because they ignore so many of the facts, starting with their recognition of God's existence and all of that. Many of them just don't want to acknowledge that even, that there is a God. Well, see, it is to be a walk that is characterized by Christian love. Chapter 5, next one, verse 2. And this may be, I'll have to double check. I don't know if we have another use of the word walk here. This may be as kind of summary. I'll have to look at that and see. But 5:2, and walk in love. The putting the other person first, or persons, or church, has to be first. Not your own niche. Not your own job, your own lifestyle, your own family, your own... all. This has to go by the wayside and become prioritized in terms of the love for others. And I'm not saying you can't apply towards these people, you should. But the walk in love has the idea of putting the other person first and being willing to make whatever application is appropriate to the situation that is in their best interest. And that's opposed, of course, to being operating in our own selfish best interest. We're good at that. That's taken as a given. You know how I know? Love your neighbor as you love yourself. God knows we love ourselves. We do whatever is necessary to take care of ourselves. Or normal people do. And we should. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm talking about it in just a normal sense of taking care of yourself. Making sure you have a place to live, food to eat, and all that stuff. And that's normal. But then we have to take that and then start applying that mentality out towards others. Walk in love, just as Christ loved you. We have a standard, a perfect example of this. So it is to be a lifestyle that is consistent with one's new nature in the Lord. That's verse 8. You were formerly darkness. Not that you just lived in darkness, but you yourself were part of the darkness. Unbelievers are part of the darkness. They not only contribute to it, they're part of it. But now you are light in the Lord. Walk like children of light. Walk as a child of light should walk. Because you are a child of light. And then it is a walk that is characterized by the discerning, prayerful, careful, and precise approach that is characteristic of the wise man. That's the verse we just saw. Be careful how you walk. Not like fools do, not like unwise men walk, but like wise men walk. And one of the things in life, I was thinking about it the other day. I heard a song by, I can't remember who it was, but it's called Breathe. Pearl Jam. I'm not a huge Pearl Jam fan, by the way, but not my tip of cup of tea. But one of the lines in it, he said, I'm a lucky man to be able to count on both hands the ones I love. And the fact is, most people really don't have relationships in this world with people they love. They're very few and they're far between. So I want to surround myself with people that are pursuing the same things, that will challenge me, that will not just say, well, you know, he's the pastor, he can do whatever he wants. First, that's not true. I mean, I know it's been taught as true, but it's not true. You can, but you're not supposed to. So again, believers will become foolish if they do not recognize that the behaviors that are characteristic of the negative and unbelieving are not appropriate to their existence. The conduct of the negative should not be reflected in lives of adjusted believers. This is why we don't socialize with them. And again, all unbelievers are off the hook. But why would you surround yourself with a negative believer? Somebody who's anti-doctrine, somebody who doesn't want the truth, somebody who's hostile to Bible class, why would you surround yourself with that kind of person? You shouldn't. That kind of person shouldn't be in your life, frankly. What have they got to offer other than dragging you down? I don't see anything they have to offer. If negative believers were getting the job done, well, then we can all go home now. We don't need to keep pursuing all this if this is really the way it works. Well, 13, they can become foolish if they are exposed to and begin to believe the specious arguments. Arguments that sound plausible. That which sounds plausible but is wrong. And their arguments, they may have in their thinking a valid point. To the thinking believer, they don't. To the discerning believer, they see through that. And in spite of all the things and all of this, and I don't care if people traveled or didn't travel, what you do with your Christian life is your business. But you got all this warning, dire warnings, we're all going to die another 5-6 weeks, we're going to have another spike, the hospitals are going to be packed, and yet when it comes to family and Thanksgiving, how many of them are willing to risk it? Bunches of them. Millions of them. And so, again, I'm not either for that or against it. I'm not saying either way what a person ought to do. But I'm saying they put family first. And that's not what the Bible teaches. Never has been. In fact, the family can be one of your biggest problems. So they can become foolish. Again, believe the arguments of those that suggest that those living ungodly lifestyles will inherit in the kingdom of God. First, they're not going to inherit, and the wrath of God comes on these ungodly lifestyles. You're not going to inherit. He's made that plain. They have no inheritance, these unbelievers. They're not even going to be a part of the kingdom. All unbelievers are going to become as nothing. They won't exist to us, frankly, in the eternal state. And how that all plays out, well, I think you're going to be happy enough with God's plan, you won't care. I don't think you're going to miss him. Oh, I didn't spend enough time with Hitler. Dang it. I don't think you're going to miss him. I'm just presuming Hitler's an unbeliever. I don't know that he was. So, not maligning Hitler. But why would you want to? Well, 14, in short, the strong adversity of contrast established by the use of the conjunction Allah, but or instead that follows indicates that being senseless is the lack of understanding God's will. Thus, if the believer is not engaged in learning and comprehending the will of God, that's where it's got to start. Now, again, that's not where it ends, but that's where it's got to start, of learning and comprehending what the truth is. He has the potential for his thinking to be compromised. Understanding the will of God indicates that the believer is not unthinking or senseless. And I've seen too many senseless believers. Too many believers that rationalize their disobedience and their failure and all of that. And again, this matter of learning and comprehending the will of God, why call me Lord and do not what I say? So that's a part of it, obviously, and that's going to be one of the questions. I think that's the question Jesus posed. Oh, you call me Lord, and so I am. But you know what? You don't do what I tell you. You blow off the royal imperatives if they get in your way. And that can't be the way we live our lives. If it is, we're headed for failure. So 16, the command uses the verb suniemi, literally to set or bring together. Which is used of physically bringing things together. It can involve bringing combatants together for a fight, a war, or bringing together in a positive way, such as in marriage. And 17, it is used figuratively to put or join things together in the mind. In that regard, it has the idea of discerning, perceiving, or understanding, to mentally be able to put things together so that it makes sense. And for the unbeliever out there living in darkness, this world doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why should it? It can't. They can't understand it. So they're not willing to go to the light and look at it and see it for what it is. So what do they have? Nothing. Well, it is used figuratively again, putting things in the mind. So 18, while the Greek noun gnosis, knowledge, deals with facts and knowledge in general, this verb does not only deal with facts and knowledge, it involves comprehending something, having an intelligent grasp of the situation or the issue. And only then, really, can you be of help to anybody else. You have to intelligently and accurately understand things. How are you going to help other people if you don't know what's going on? And the point is, you can't, really. So the phrase that follows, tito thelema tu kuriu. What the will of the Lord? What is the will of the Lord? Is an indirect question. The direct question, what we're trying to understand, is what is the will of the Lord? That's the direct question. That's the only thing we have to ask ourselves. What is God's will? You say, well, I know God's will, but sometimes I don't want to do it. Well, join the club. We're all there. We've all done that. But knowing what it is quite important. Well, because at first, if you don't know what it is, you have zero chance of doing it. I mean, well, practically zero. You could stumble into it, I suppose. A stop clock's right twice a day, so maybe. But knowing it surely gives you an advantage. The advantage of wisdom is that it brings success. And the advantage of failing to have wisdom, well, there are no advantages to being senseless. There are no advantages to being stupid. We used to have this guy who worked, I remember, and of course, his name told me something. His name was Joe Fry. And he worked, when I first was at Whataburger, he worked with me there in Oklahoma City. And his philosophy, which he proudly espoused to everybody, is dumb is where it's at. And he literally would go around telling people this. Dumb is where it's at. You shouldn't really, you don't need to know anything. And this was his approach to life. You think that isn't stupid? And then to broadcast it around. Dumb is where it's at. Huh. Well, I would even go with Timothy Leary over that. The name of the game is to feel real good. That's more appealing to me than dumb is where it's at. Both are wrong, by the way. I'm not taking sides. Both are wrong. But I'm just saying, if you're going to have some stupid philosophy, you at least have one that's self-indulgent, I guess. I don't know. So the question is, and the force of the entire command is that believers should constantly be asking, understanding, what is God's will in every situation? What does God want? And then seeking to execute that will. And that'll be a challenge because sometimes your old sin nature will oppose it. Sometimes demons will oppose it. Sometimes other believers and unbelievers will oppose it. But you have to have the moxie and the iron in your soul to stand there and do what's right. Well, 21, the Greek noun thelema, will, can be used of the act of willing or desiring something. It is used more frequently to denote the result of what one had decided, that which has been willed. Again, the ma suffix tends to be passive, what has been willed. What is God's will? What does he will? And in that regard, the will of God should be understood to denote what God has objectively desired and decides. This is what we have to ask ourselves. What does God want and not what do I want? We know what we want. And generally, again, it can easily be the path of least resistance and all that. That's the easy way. Well, as mentioned previously in Ephesians, the term will is used over 60 times in the New Testament. And is mostly used about 50 of those times to refer to the divine will. 24, it is only used twice in the plural, which would again emphasize that God's will is not diverse or fluctuating. Rather, it is viewed as a powerful unity. That comes out of the TDNT. And 25, while God's directive will is indeed his unified approach to all things, it is very detailed. Now, in that regard, in a general sense, we can know major things about God's will that are generally true. We live in the church age. It's generally true that the local church is the vehicle through which God is operating. The local church is the pillar and support of the truth. We can know basic, broad things. Face-to-face teaching is the way to go. That's what's envisioned in the New Testament teachers and the epistles. They talk about why they wanted to be face-to-face. They didn't want to write letters. And all of that. So if Paul didn't want to write letters, I think this probably rules out emails, IMs, text messaging, all those. He would say those are not important compared to face-to-face teaching, I think. And so that's going to be our will in the matter. So again, some things are broad. We can easily understand. What's the will of God in an explicit situation involving a person? That you have to figure out. And God's there to help us. It's not as though he just abandons us. You figure it out. I'll leave you on your own. He's provided us the doctrine. Positive believers. When three or four or five positive believers around you are telling you the same thing, that's God. And people still ignore that. I don't know how many times I've taught that. If all the positive people around you are saying one thing and you're headed in the other direction, you're in trouble. That's a fact. Again, this is why we surround ourselves with intelligent believers who are positive themselves, who want the truth and want to do it right. I don't want to surround myself. I never have. I said that in the beginning, even before I ever got a church. I said, I don't care how many there are, as long as the group I get is positive and serious about the truth. And God's validated that and vindicated that, I think. So you want to surround yourself with believers that are quality. Not just believers. This is one of the things that was never taught to many people early on. So they married unbelievers or they married negative believers because they just thought, well, I've got to find a positive person or something, or a believer to marry. Well, no, you really want a positive believer is what you want. That's what you really want in marriage. Because believe me, marriage is difficult enough with two positive believers living in the same house. You got two sin natures. And unless one of you is brain dead, you're going to have conflict. And that's with two positive believers trying to work it out in the last days. Can you imagine how much more difficult that's made when one doesn't have even a spiritual thought in their brains? That they don't pursue God's plan. They're just doing whatever they're doing. Frittering their life. They're not redeeming the time, I can tell you that. Whatever they're doing, they're not doing that. So we are commanded to do so. So the believer must seek to understand and apply God's will to each circumstance on an ongoing basis. You say, well, I'd like a week off. No, I don't think so. I don't think Paul says here, well, when you feel like it, when it's convenient, if you don't have anything else going on. I think this has to be the entire approach to life. Well, with respect to God's will, the following may be observed. A, the will of God is the basis for all existence. Apart from God's determination, nothing would exist. And this is where the unbeliever out there is completely lost. He thinks this world, he thinks 0 + 0 = 1. He thinks this world manufactured itself out of nothing. And it's a pretty complex place to come out of nothing, really. And so, like I say, this is a Timex. But even though it's not a Rolex, I think it says, oh, it's a Tolex. I'm sorry. But somebody designed this. This didn't just pop up out of the ground. And that's a small thing. That's a little bitty deal. Even the ring you got in your hand, somebody designed that. Somebody planned it. Nothing, inanimate objects don't make themselves. So you have to explain this, I guess. But that's the point. God is capable. God is the basis for everything. Apart from God, nothing would exist. If you stop and think about that very long, well, first it'll burn your brain out. But if you stop thinking about it very long, where did everything come from? How did it get here? And either you believe that two nothings got together and became a something, that stuff just springs up out of nowhere, spontaneous combustion exists. And fires don't break out just spontaneously, generally. There's conditions that set it up. And you have to have all the proper conditions to have this stuff. Well, where do the conditions come from? So the idea that a single point of whatever they thought the Big Bang, a single point of compacted something blew up and became an entire universe. Wow, that is far-fetched. But that is the cosmic darkness. That's what they believe. And so when you talk about this, well, he makes it plain here, Revelation 4, 11. Worthy are you, our Lord and our God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and because of your will they existed and were created. And note that they existed within his will before he created them. That they came out of his genius. They weren't just created arbitrarily. He willed all things into existence. Can you will something into existence? Have you been able to do that? No. And even a small thing. Come on. Will me a piece of bread into existence. No, we can't do anything like that. And yet God's created an entire universe with all that's in it. Intelligent creatures, angels, men, animals. Lack consciousness, and all, or self-consciousness anyway. They're conscious. And then the inanimate creation that lacks consciousness at all. Nobody picked. See, that's the whole thing. Another, this is his sovereign choice. He determined what to create and who to create. And when he created souls, he determined how to create your soul, what you would be like. And that your presence within his plan has the potential for advancing that plan or for not. That's kind of our deal. Well, B, God's sovereignty is such that he is fully capable of executing his will on every portion of his creation. Anyone who thinks they're beyond the reach of God will find out that they're not. They're going to find that out. And people are wondering, and then of course today I just got, as I was watching the weather, that's the one thing I will try to watch to see what's happening. I could just look outside, but what's the weather? I need somebody to tell me. He's a meteorologist. I can't just look outside and see it 74. He's got to tell me. Well, he executes his will on every portion of his creation, that nothing is beyond his reach. So all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he's talking about people, not just the internal creation or the inanimate or even animate creation. He's talking about the inhabitants of the earth don't mean anything to God. I mean, they do mean something to him, but the reason they're counted as nothing is because if they're negative in the end, they won't mean anything. They just won't amount to anything or mean anything. Their entire existence will be useless. And we have the opportunity to serve the living God and literally make something of ourselves spiritually, if we choose to. But he does according to his will in the host of heaven. Oh, the demons aren't beyond his reach. Satan's not beyond his reach. And among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" Now, that's not true at a certain level because people question God all the time. What he means is nobody effectively does it. You don't ever tell God, "Stop!" in the name of love. No, you can't make God stop if he wants to do something. God does his will. And his will transcends everybody's will. He's got the trump card in that regard, in terms of his will. So you're not going to effectively tell God, "Stop it." God will do what he chooses to do. And so in this time of great tragedy and, oh, everybody's all this and that, I was looking at the most massive hurricane season ever been on record, and Florida was missed completely. What are the odds? That's pretty amazing odds when you look at all the storms, 30 of them. And there's still a couple more out there. They won't come this way, but still potentially a couple more forming. 30 storms, 13 major hurricanes, and nothing touched Florida. That seems odd. Or God was protecting us and blessed us. Well, see, all believers should recognize there is a distinction to be made between the imperfect and fallible will of humans and the perfect and infallible will of God. It's hard to say, but I can be wrong. I know none of you struggle with this, but we can all be wrong, of course. But one of the things he talks about here is the lack of human will that's involved in just the scriptures themselves, even. These interpretations and scriptures and prophecy. No prophecy was ever made by an act of human will. The truth doesn't come from humans willing it to be so. It comes because God wills it so. But men moved by the Holy Spirit, they were parts in this. They had their part they played. In this, men did, but the Holy Spirit's the one who is doing the speaking, speaking from God. So in that regard, Jesus certainly demonstrated that human will was to subject itself to the divine will when and if the two come into conflict. Well, I don't think we have to say when and if. Jesus did, but we just have to say when. Our will conflict with God's will at certain times. And it doesn't take much to set us off sometimes. I see this in my own life. Anybody that's been married for any amount of time happens. You know where each other's buttons are. You know how to push them. You know how to just make that little offhand comment that you know is probably going to create trouble, but you don't care. I've done it. You've done it. I bet we've all done it. And but there will be a conflict between our will and God's will. When Jesus came into conflict with his human will, with the divine will, what did he do? And he went a little farther beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Your will is what's important here. And he knew what all this meant. And this wasn't just a trip to the cross, although that didn't sound that much fun. This meant spiritual death. This meant that he was going to die. Not just physically, but he was going to die spiritually. He was essentially going to be separated from God, what we would call go to hell, so we didn't have to. Because that's what hell is. It's eternal separation from God. Now, he wasn't eternally separated from him. But what happened in that 3-hour period is is an eternal factor that goes far beyond what we could imagine. The suffering that he endured in 3 hours. And if you're in hell, how much time passes? Does it matter? You can say, well, do you want to be, I'd like to be in hell 5 seconds to see what it's like. No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. Jesus didn't want to. But of course, he had spiritual life all his life. He knew. Okay, well, our time is gone today. We're going to have to stop there. We'll consider this about God's will and pick up here. Next time we meet, you will need the Doctrine of Fools and Folly before you. We'll have time to finish this up probably on Tuesday and get to that. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would strengthen our souls with the truth so that we might effectively represent you in the angelic conflict. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.